Well then, to start, thank you all very much for coming today. I know it's a relatively early morning session and the day after the election, so happy to have some of you here. So I'm going to be talking today about the interactions between groundwater and rice cultivation, specifically floodwater-groundwater interactions in California rice systems. So to give you a little bit of background, a lot of people may not realize that rice is grown in California. I mean, I spent the first 18 years of my life living in California without ever thinking about rice cultivation in California. But California actually produces about 25% of all rice grown in the U.S. And in that kind of northern Sacramento, or in the Sacramento Valley area, the northern part of the Central Valley, is really the main growing region for rice in California. And really most of this is irrigated with surface water. And sometimes in drought years, like 2015, some of you may or may not know, but there was a pretty significant drought, 2012, and technically still ongoing. But in 2015, a lot more groundwater was starting to be used. But in general, it's a surface water irrigated system. And so to give you a little background of what this system looks like, generally planting starts in about April, May. The fields are flooded for pretty usually the entire duration of the rice growing season, which lasts into September, October when it's drained for that harvest. The straw, rice straw, is incorporated since there's no or very limited open burning anymore, so it's incorporated into the soil to allow for decomposition. And then the fields are actually flooded again in the winter for winter fallow, which is important for that rice straw decomposition, but also for the waterfowl habitat on the Pacific Flyway. And then the flood ends in, you know, January, February, somewhere around there. And then the fields are prepared again to start the cycle over. And on the, I guess it would be your right here, but that's kind of a diagram of one of our rice fields. So basically there's a inlet at the top, there's an outlet at the bottom, and there's multiple checks that have kind of flow through of water between checks. And also, just to, I'm going to be talking about a little later, so bordering this field, you have levees that are generally access roads, not always, but so it might be around 5 meters wide, with sometimes drainage ditches, other fields on the other side. And these are very different from the infield levees, which are a lot smaller and not as structurally different. So our goal is really to look at the water balance in rice fields and the water loss pathways. And so Bruce Lindquist, who is here today, he's a rice specialist in charge of our lab, and he did a study that basically started looking at this problem, the total water balance, and did a really nice job of quantifying water inputs to the fields, the outputs, because a lot of these are flow-through systems, so you have water coming in and spilling out at the tailwater all the time, and then also calculating the evapotranspiration, and then actually using the water balance approach took the infiltration and seepage to be the difference of that calculation. But in this case, those weren't actually measured. It was a water balance calculation. And so what we're going from here is really trying to put more of a number on this and actually measure these flows directly and understand a little bit more how the groundwater may affect these. And one of the reasons is because during the recent drought in 2015, a lot of growers were anecdotally reporting a lot higher water input requirements per unit area. So even though with the water shortages, they might be fallowing around 25% of the historical rice acreage, per unit area, they're actually putting on more water. And so that just kind of indicated that there's a lot we actually don't understand about water flows in this system. And our goal is to specifically focus on these flows, the lateral seepage through levees, both could be into or out of the field, and then the interactions with groundwater, either groundwater pushing up into the system through groundwater flows and capillary rise, or percolation down into the groundwater. So that's really the goal of this system. And to give you a little background on the groundwater here, so this is on your left, this is basically a map of groundwater elevation. And you can see that coming, the groundwater flows in from the sides of the Central Valley, and then kind of down the Central Valley towards the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta around the San Francisco Bay Area. But really, there's not a lot of color difference there throughout the majority of the Sacramento Valley, indicating that this is a fairly flat region with groundwater elevations that are fairly close to the surface through a lot of this, especially when there's not a lot of pumping for groundwater. But as you can see on the right, this is This is the change in elevation between 2010 and 2015, which kind of encapsulates the drought years pretty well. And a lot of this area, a lot of that is rice-growing area, and a lot of it saw some pretty significant declines in the groundwater table from those years. So what might have kind of historically been true in normal years did change quite a bit in the drought. So our objectives, as I kind of talked about a bit, are to better understand these groundwater surface water interactions in California rice fields, and then also to try and quantify the contribution of these subsurface water flows, the ones that we maybe don't understand so well yet, particularly lateral seepage and deep percolation, percolation below the root zone, and put that in the context of the total water budget for California rice fields. And we think that in most of these cases, that the groundwater basically rises through percolation to meet the episaturated zone, the zone occupied by saturated from the floodwater, and so that there doesn't actually end up being an unsaturated or evados zone, that they become contiguous. And we also believe that lateral seepage and percolation water losses represent a small fraction of the total water balance, and that lateral seepage losses probably dominate this due to the heavy clay soils and the low saturated hydraulic conductivity associated with this. So our methodology, this is a very simple diagram, and for some of you this may be a review, but basically we installed piezometers at three different depths. And using these different depths, based on the water level, which is a measurement of the hydraulic head in these systems, so these are just basically PVC tubes. They have an intake only at the bottom, only at that depth, specific depth. So that allows you to determine the hydraulic head at that point. And so on the left here, we see that in the shallowest piezometer, the hydraulic head is the greatest, and in the deepest, it's the smallest. And so in that case, there's downward flow because you have a head gradient in the downward direction. In the rightmost, you have the highest hydraulic head in the deepest piezometer, so you have an upward flow gradient. And then in the middle, we have a situation where all water levels are equal, which would indicate to us no flow. And so that's kind of the basic principle behind what we're doing. And so a little schematic diagram of our field, we basically had what I just mentioned, these nests of piezometers in the field, three replicates at three different depths. We also had, over on the right, in the infield levees, which are pretty similar structurally to the field. These are the ones separating checks in the field, not the ones surrounding the field. So we had, just for comparison, to make sure we weren't seeing anything anomalous due to the kind of floodwater on top, we had a levee and piezometer nest. Then we have percolation rings, which are inserted at 25 centimeters. And those basically just, we keep the water height higher than the surrounding floodwater. And that allows us to measure percolation because it's covered for preventing evapotranspiration. There's no inflow from the sides. And then lastly, we have these seepage frames. So I'll talk more about those in a minute. But basically, these are three-sided nested frames that are inserted into the these are the external levees of the rice field. So these are the ones bordering drainage ditches or other fields, not the ones within the field. And we maintain a constant head of water in there and then measure the amount of volume of water lost through the levees. And so we do this so those are the infield levees, whereas on the left side you have the external levees. And we do this through the growing season, and also I don't have that data to report yet, but we have been monitoring the total water balance to put this into context, the inflow, the evapotranspiration, and the outflow. And also with the piezometers, we can see kind of what the groundwater table is doing throughout the growing season as we monitor this. And then after harvest, we keep most of this equipment in to still be able to monitor the groundwater levels and any changes in hydraulic head. We don't make lateral seepage measurements because we don't feel like those would be a bit erroneous. And we still make percolation ring measurements, but with a second ring to keep cracking from giving anomalous high readings. So that's a picture of our field setup, the piezometers and the percolation rings, and this is a picture of our nested seepage frames, so a little bit of what those look like. And this is based on a methodology developed by Janssen and Leonard's in 2009. So our first site, we have three sites, Richvale, Arbuckle, and Woodland, just kind of spread on a north-south transect throughout the Central Valley, or the Sacramento Valley, really. And basically what we see here is you have the head gradient, so this is just centimeters of head difference per centimeters of depth in the soil. And basically between 30 and 75 centimeters below the soil surface is the top line. and between 75 and 135 centimeters below the soil surface is the bottom. And what you can see is that when the head gradient is positive, meaning you have, as you decline in depth, you also decline in hydraulic head, so you get a positive gradient since that's head over depth. You have downward flow, and you have upward flow when it's negative. So you have that a head gradient that basically increases as you go down in elevation or down in depth. And what we see here is that you have upward flow from the groundwater. So between in this bottom segment, you have upward flow, and you have downward flow in the top. So what is really, we think, is happening here is, and also confirmed by some nearby piezometers that showed this unsaturated zone, is basically here you maintain this unsaturated zone long into the growing season. So you have both water flows coming from the floodwater above and the groundwater below. And you see they kind of start to come together a bit, likely as this unsaturated zone shrinks. But really, you have water flow from both directions with a vadose zone or an unsaturated zone, which is quite a bit different from what we see in our second site. This is Arbuckle. And there's a little bit of variation here, but you can see that pretty much these two gradients overlap. So again, the light blue dashed line is the shallower interval, and the purple solid line is the deeper interval between the two depths. And these are both positive hydraulic head gradients indicating downward flow. So in this case, what we see is that in both our two intervals, we see downward flow of water. And then in our last site in Woodland, we see a very similar thing to Arbuckle, although there is a little bit more difference in the head gradients between, we can see in the light blue dashed line, the shallower interval has a steeper hydraulic head gradient. And to be honest, this is something we're still trying to figure out. We don't know exactly what's going on here. In order to get the flow, you also have to multiply the head gradient by the hydraulic conductivity. So, for example, if there's a higher bulk density or something else, the compacted layer that's limiting the hydraulic conductivity in this top layer, that could explain this. Or also, you might explain this with some lateral movement. And then, briefly, just looking into our percolation and lateral seepage losses, you can see that there's definitely a bit of variability. Interestingly, Richvale, where we saw that unsaturated zone, really shows the highest percolation, which kind of makes a bit of sense as you don't have that contiguous groundwater and floodwater. But overall, really, percolation as a total percentage of the water budget, you might be looking at 150 centimeters here. So it's a pretty low amount. And lateral seepage, we also see a lot of variation there. You know, this is very dependent on soil structure and other kind of things that might have a lot of heterogeneity. But again, you see a lot of variation there. So basically, to summarize real quick, at two of the three sites, the entire profile became quickly saturated, and the head gradient showed that downward flow or percolation. At one of the three sites, it persisted; an unsaturated zone persisted with flow upward from the groundwater and flow downward from the floodwater. And our lateral seepage and percolation losses are generally small but highly variable. So in the future, we're working to put this in the total water balance context. We'd also like to characterize a bit of this variation in lateral seepage and characterize the infield variability of percolation losses. So with that, I'd like to thank our lab manager, Cesar Abrenia, Nadeem Akbar, who is our visiting scholar that helped us a lot, or a visiting professor, and the Department of Plant Sciences and the California Rice Research Board at UC for providing us with funding. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Do you think that when you do this, you could extrapolate somehow? I'm thinking about the, winter research question and all that, and how this information might contribute knowledge to that. The information we already have about winter research and how this information might influence decisions about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. A lot of these things, not only is there a lot of kind of heterogeneity between fields, but also even within fields. So you have to be a bit careful about extrapolating. That said, you know, we do have good soil maps in California, and you can, for example, that first site I showed you, Richvale, the one that had this unsaturated zone that persisted, that's seems fairly representative of, you know, this relatively large area in Butte County, one of the counties. So I do think we tried to choose these sites with that in mind, that we kind of were trying to, I mean, picking growers that would work with us, but also picking areas that we could extrapolate a bit based on those. But yeah, no, I think it's definitely, you have to be a bit careful about extrapolating, and I think it's an area that needs more study. Yes?
So, based on these results, can you say how much water is reaching aquifer, or is there any kind of recharge happening, or is it net withdrawal, or can you make any comments like that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, we can, looking at the percolation data, it's all, you know, fairly preliminary data, but I think we can say that that is, you know, percolation that is going into eventually the groundwater. But at the same time, you see that the groundwater table in this area is really very high. And I think there's a big question. It's interesting at some of the sites to look at kind of the trend in the water table elevation. And it doesn't always follow, you know, these flooded fields, right? And so it's going up sometimes even when the fields are drained, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. So I think there's a lot at the landscape scale happening with the irrigation canals and things like that that are also providing recharge. So I think on the whole, it's a bit hard to quantify the recharge provided by, for example, rice agriculture in this region, because you have things like the irrigation canals, you have, and as you mentioned, a lot of variability. But I think that we can, you know, for a particular field, start to look at what's going to recharge, yes.
Is Mohammed here?
Okay, so we're going to have a little bit of extra time because our second speaker has not shown up. So, I have a question, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
Now that you're up there. So, when you're looking at all of this water and flooding, does the appearance of, in some, you know, variability of these locations, does it appear that some of the seepage or the leakage of the water out affects some of the yields in those areas, or is there higher management levels that they're having to do to maintain those water levels in the areas where it's essentially leaking out?
I'd say normally growers don't have a problem. I mean, they can keep water on the field for the most part when they need to. Like I mentioned, 2015 was a bit of an anomaly. We talked to some growers who did mention, you know, we talked to one grower, for example, who mentioned that as soon as they started pumping this well, we mentioned they were irrigating with more groundwater, then their neighbor couldn't keep water on their field. You know, just that kind of dramatic effect. But in general, I'd say that the growers have a pretty easy time keeping water on the field. This is really kind of research to try and understand the water flows in these systems, because it is getting to be a lot more contentious of an issue in California, and being able to say, okay, this amount's lost to percolation or lateral seepage is really important for that. But at the point, I don't think it's a big concern for right now for management or the economics of the system. I think they have a pretty, you know, it's surface water deliveries and not a huge portion of their time or their money for it.
We won't keep Gabe up there for the next week. So let's give him a hand.
Thank you.